As we kick off the new year, many of us resolve to grow closer to God. But how do we actually do that? Well, we have a resource to help you do just that through our free ebook, 5 Ways to Connect with God. This resource shares 5 simple but powerful spiritual practices to deepen your relationship with God, from cultivating thankfulness to asking God for a word for the year. This guide will help you to find rest, focus, and renewed connection with God as we begin the new year. Download your copy now at premierinsight.org. Start your year off closer to God. That's premierinsight.org. Now, let's get started with today's episode.
The Ask NT Wright Anything podcast is back.
Hello, this is Tom Wright speaking to you from my study here in Oxford in England. I'm really looking forward to the fact that Mike Bird and I are relaunching the Ask NT Wright Anything podcast, looking at key questions that people have sent in, but also developing some themes that he and I have been interested in and we're eager to talk about with one another.
Listen today on your chosen podcast provider and head to asknwright.com to submit your question.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it.
Before we dive into today's episode, I want to quickly let you know about an exciting event that we've got coming up with Professor Alistair McGrath in Oxford. On Wednesday the 5th of February, I will be recording a live episode of the show with Alistair, which will include an exciting opportunity for you to ask him your own questions. The title of the event is The C.S. Lewis You Never Knew, Exploring Meaning, Truth and Technology, and it will be held at Wycliffe Hall in Oxford at 5:30 p.m. Tickets are free, but they do need to be booked in advance, and there are details of how to do that in the show notes. Alistair and I would love you to join us on Wednesday the 5th of February at Wycliffe Hall in Oxford at 5:30 p.m.
But now for today's show.
In this episode, we're going to be hearing from Dr. Sarah Waters, an assistant professor of language and literature at Sterling College, Kansas, and a specialist in William Shakespeare and C.S. Lewis. She's published numerous academic papers and is working on a new book about Lewis and Shakespeare. Among other things, in this conversation, Sarah's going to be sharing some of the context for a paper that she presented at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University. The title of Sarah's paper was An Undiscovered Source in Lewis's Conversion Narrative. Sarah, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, a lot of your work today obviously involves C.S. Lewis, but how did you first encounter him?
Yeah, it's a great question. I was read some of the Narnia books as a child. I was brought up in a Christian household, so Narnia was sort of par of the course, I think. But we actually didn't own all of the Narnia books, and we had a sort of strange collection of them. So I didn't necessarily read them in logical, or have them read to me in logical order. So it starts with The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. But then we had The Silver Chair, we had The Last Battle, and I got The Magician's Nephew out of the library when someone reprimanded me for reading them in the wrong order. And I'm glad I read them in the order that I did, except that it was quite strange. So I had read the end of Narnia before I knew some of the sort of interim stories, like The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, we just didn't have. And so I didn't actually read those until significantly later in life. And it wasn't until I came to decide what I wanted to do my postgraduate research on that I sort of came back to thinking about Lewis from a more academic perspective.
I'm glad you read it in that order. I feel like there are lots of people that feel quite strongly about the fact that The Magician's Nephew is certainly not the first book to be read.
I think you lose, if nothing else, you lose the excitement about the lamppost. And that to me, I'm glad I got that excitement.
Yeah, and I feel like today lots of people do prequels way after the original, don't they?
Yeah, sometimes better than others.
Yes. Sarah, in what ways do you feel like Lewis, we're going to be talking about his impact on your work specifically, but do you feel like there's any areas where Lewis has particularly impacted your life in any way?
Well, there's a sort of practical way in that I spend most of my life now working on Lewis. So I guess he's had that impact, for better or for worse. But I think also one impact that he's had on me, I think, is to do with the way that he writes, and his style of writing, which is often criticized for not being sort of academic enough, by which people mean it hasn't got enough footnotes or hasn't, which is what we mean by academic writing now. But what it is really good at doing, and I wish academic writing would do significantly more of this, is being accessible in the truest sense, in that he's really grounded in his primary thinking and his primary work with these sources. But he also is thinking critically about them and writing in a way that experts can benefit from, but also those who are becoming experts, so undergraduate students and so on, can really benefit from as well. And he's very, very good at doing something I am less good at sometimes in my academic writing, which is being very clear all the way through. And he writes in a way that's sort of deceptively simple. It's not as simple as it looks. And so I think, at least in a kind of mentorship, his writing has also had a significant impact on the way that I write.
Yeah, and I suppose as someone who is interacting with students day in, day out, that's right. A really significant thing for you, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And I think also that clarity comes across in his apologetics as well. So he's dealing with often very complicated ideas, but trying to make them as familiar as they can be to, you know, his neighbour down the street. And part of that, I think, comes from his broadcasting, but also his approach to academic writing. Well.
Yeah. Sarah, this might be really hard to whittle down, but if I had to push you, do you have a favourite quote or a favourite book or a favourite work of his?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say that my favourite work of his is constantly shifting. Mm-hmm. And probably to make it easier, I'll go with my favourite Narnia book, which is The Silver Chair at the moment. And that's partly just because of the fantastic scene that we have of Puddleglum smashing out the fire. And it's just so, just the imagery that's there is just so striking. But yeah, it's very difficult to pick a favourite.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's different favourites at different times and stages of
absolutely.
Your life as well,
yeah.
Isn't there?
Yeah.
I mean, on that note, Sarah, do you feel like there's anything that you have read, obviously probably from an academic perspective, but I guess thinking more from a personal perspective, where you've changed your mind because of something that you've read in Lewis?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm going to use an example from a sermon that he gave in 1939, which is called Learning in Wartime. He's asked to give this sermon, and the premise of the sermon is basically, if the world is at war with one another, what business do we have to be here studying? You know, ought we not be fighting the good fight and so on? It's a really difficult question to answer, right? And Lewis, I think, has a really good way of capturing what he thinks, what he sees to be the best response, the Christian response to this, which is essentially that we're actually always at a state of spiritual war. And in that state, we ought to be constantly thinking about it. The irony is that we're not thinking about it all the time, except that when we're involved in actual conflict, perhaps we do think about it significantly more. And so it's not just the case that we, you know, shouldn't be doing it during wartime, but actually, do we have any business to be doing it anyway? And the way that he frames thinking about vocation and actually our work, our calling might be to be there studying or to be there teaching. That is our calling, and that is as important whether we're in peacetime or wartime. So I think I first read that during the very early days of the COVID pandemic. And so I think that's partly why it's just so ingrained in my mind in terms of, you know, the world is imploding. What right do we have to be still teaching students literature? Actually, that's a question we should always be thinking about.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that feels very relevant in light of a global pandemic, doesn't it?
Right.
Sarah, you mentioned that you first encountered the Lewis books because you were in a Christian household and the Narnia books were part and parcel of you know, your childhood. Do you feel like Lewis's work has in any way informed or played a significant role in the beliefs that you hold now?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I would say probably not as much as it has for a lot of Lewis scholars. And that's partly because, so I encountered the Narnia books And then my father tells me that he lent me Screwtape and I didn't read it. I'd have no recollection of this. I'm sure he's right. I just don't remember it. but the next book I then read by Lewis was Preface to Paradise Lost, because I was studying Paradise Lost at university. So I had quite a big sort of gap in between. I didn't read, you know, any other fiction or anything at that stage. And so I was sort of developing and coming to faith in that in-between period. So I think Lewis has had a significant impact in the way that I think about faith since I've started reading a lot more of his apologetics. But he wasn't sort of heavily involved in my conversion experience, just because I had this sort of weird gap in between, where normally the sort of trajectory you might think would be, well, you read Narnia, then you go on and you read maybe the Silent Planet and so on. And I didn't do that. I did come to it later, and we had plenty of Lewis in the house. I just wasn't reading.
Brilliant. Well, let's talk a little bit about your work, because you have focused, a significant amount of your focus has been on C.S. Lewis. Why did you decide to focus your research on C.S. Lewis and the Inklings?
Yeah, well, I have probably a fairly unusual story when it comes to this. I actually came to Lewis through Shakespeare, as I said. I had these books as a child, but then when I was trying to decide what I wanted to do my master's thesis on, I had two options. One was to do with the Bildungsroman narrative and Pope's Rape of the Lock, which I dreamt up in some sort of weird night dream, I think. and the other was I wanted to think about how we use Shakespeare today. So I'd become really interested when I was studying Shakespearean drama in thinking about adaptation and appropriation. And I was really interested to think about, okay, how do we repurpose Shakespeare and not necessarily even just in the play form? What does that look like? So I got kind of interested in things like 10 Things I Hate About You and so on, as interesting ways of reconceptualizing these stories. And I knew there had been some work done on Tolkien and Shakespeare. A book had just come out, edited by, I think it's Janet Brennan Croft, had done a text on that. So I was aware of the Ents and Macbeth and so on. But I thought, on somewhat of a whim, that maybe Lewis, who had written, I knew, academic writing at this stage, not necessarily about Shakespeare, but I knew he'd written on Milton, or maybe he had some kind of Shakespearean influences. So I put together a proposal to look at Shakespeare and Narnia. I, at that stage, and this is something you should obviously never do, had no idea whether or not there was any kind of link. I hoped. I applied for the project. I got the kind of go-ahead. And then I read desperately over Christmas the entire Chronicles of Narnia, hoping against hope I might find some links. And thankfully, I did. And not just sort of spurious links, because I was looking for them, very direct connections. And so that's sort of how my journey into Lewis studies began. Via Shakespeare rather than via Lewis, if that makes sense.
That's really interesting. It's really interesting, isn't it, as well, that you encountered him as a kid and then you came to faith, and as you say, Lewis didn't particularly play a part, but then he appeared afterwards.
Yeah.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too. Before we get back to today's show, I want to introduce you to Christopher Gasson, who has a new book about finding God in atheist books. Christopher, what inspired you to write The Devil's Gospels?
I was running a teenage discussion group at Oxford's University Church when I decided that the best way to help them build their faith upon a rock was to tackle atheism head on. Each month we explored a different atheist book. I found two things. First, these writers, like Dawkins and Nietzsche, aren't really a threat to God. They're mainly angry about how the church has interpreted Jesus' teaching, and I think we can learn from that. Second, I found that the grown-ups in the church also really wanted better answers to atheist challenges.
So do you think we can become better Christians by reading atheist books?
That's the paradox. But I think it's very much in line with what the university church is all about. Oxford University was founded on the principle that everything that we can learn about the world will deepen our understanding of God. That's as true today as it was 900 years ago, and it applies as much to science as it does to the humanities, and indeed atheism.
So Christopher, where can we find the book?
The Devil's Gospels is available on Amazon and in all good bookshops, Otherwise, head to thedevilsgospels.com where you can find more details.
Thank you, Christopher. And now back to today's show.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. Well, let's talk about Shakespeare and his influence on C.S. Lewis and perhaps some of the parallels that we might see in his work. I mean, do we know when C.S. Lewis might have first encountered William Shakespeare, or is that something we're sort of making a guess at?
Yeah, so he talks pretty early on in his letters to his father about Shakespeare. Now, probably one of the reasons for this is that we know that Lewis's father quoted Shakespeare pretty extensively in his own work and was interested in Shakespeare. So he might have just been sort of thinking, well, you know, you like these plays too. This is a sort of point of connection. But he really doesn't like Shakespeare as a child, really doesn't like him. There's a couple of plays that he sort of gives a sort of fair pass to, and he says, well, I kind of like them because they're sort of like fairy tales, but I'm not really that interested in Shakespeare. And then when he comes back to Shakespeare and he buys, I think it's the Temple edition of Shakespeare, he buys sort of in his teenage years, and he starts really enjoying reading them for the story at that point. He writes to his friend Arthur Greaves quite a bit about this. And then we know, or I know at least because I've looked at some of his marginalia, but we can track when he's reading different editions of Shakespeare, mostly because he's pretty good at dating it on the whole. Not always, but sometimes. And when he's not good at dating it, you can figure it out by the handwriting on the whole. And he comes back and starts talking about how much he enjoys Shakespeare. And he draws on this later in his academic writing. And he basically says, I really enjoyed Shakespeare until I started encountering the criticism who told me I ought to think this or that about the play. And then he talks about how he had this critic at the elbow that really prohibited him from enjoying these stories for just the stories. And once he'd sort of realized that he could have his own views and broke away from that, actually he then had this great level of enjoyment.
And do we know if he had any favourite Shakespeare plays at all?
I would say that based on the quantity that he wrote about Hamlet, that's probably his most favourite. But he doesn't talk in terms of sort of favourite plays in the same way. He talks about plays that he doesn't enjoy.
Sure.
Less so about plays that he did. You sort of, by sheer volume of references, you can kind of figure out the ones that he's at least more familiar with. But I think at different stages, he's teaching different Shakespeare plays as well. So he'll just refer to them more because he's more.
Yeah. Sarah, do you see any obvious parallels with Lewis and some of Shakespeare's works?
I think we see some interesting connections in terms of the way that Lewis is thinking through critical issues. So when he's thinking through issues about how we represent ideas about death, for instance, you'll find that he frequently turns to Hamlet, which of course is a play that deals with death. In fact, Lewis argues that's kind of the main thing going on in Hamlet. And so I think he's drawing on the plays sometimes as a kind of touchstone point. So he does this very famously, for instance, in his Apologetics. To give an example of this, in The Four Loves, he uses King Lear as an example of a character who is very, very selfish and is obsessed with need love, which is one of the concepts Lewis talks about in The Four Loves. And he uses King Lear on the basis that, and he has this great quotation where he talks about how if you and I were neighbours and we lived on the same street, I'd be able to use a reference from contemporary life. However, we are not. And so I am forced to go to more literary references. And at the time, he knows his audience is probably going to have some familiarity with at least the basic plot of King Lear, whereas they might not have familiarity with the basic tenets of Christianity, right? Which is one of the things he's trying to kind of unpack there. And so he uses King Lear as this example of a very selfish character who basically, for those of you that don't know the play, begins the play by demanding that all his daughters tell them how much they love him publicly. And as he's demanding, you must tell me how much you love me, The first two daughters speak in very excessive terms. His final youngest daughter, who loves him the most, says nothing. And this is deeply offensive to him because he needs to be shown how much he is loved. The irony of course, is that that is showing the deep level of love. So he uses that kind of example because he knows his audience will get the link.
Yeah, so I guess there's a fair bit of explicit reference there. Are there any less obvious places in Lewis's writing where he perhaps drew on Shakespeare in a more indirect way?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I recently published an article thinking about Lewis and Hamlet, and particularly thinking about Lewis, Hamlet, and The Last Battle. Now, The Last Battle is not necessarily as Shakespearean in terms of the number of references that we get. But it is a text, quite unusually for a children's book, that is absolutely full of the atmosphere of death all the way through. We get right from the beginning this kind of apocalyptic imagery and so on. And I think one of many sources that Lewis is drawing on there is Hamlet. And one of the reasons I think this is that he, in his lecture, which is called Hamlet, the Prince of a Poem, which is first given to the British Academy in 1942, he says there very clearly that there is this atmosphere of death in the play. And he talks about how that sort of pervades everything. And I don't think it's the only thing influencing The Last Battle, but I think it's one of sort of many sources, as well as things like Revelation and so on, that he's aware of that emphasis on death in Hamlet. And actually, The Last Battle is much more redemptive than Hamlet allows. We get to see the life beyond the grave that Hamlet's only contemplating, right?
And I guess even there, it's fairly explicit imagery that he's using that is perhaps reminiscent of Hamlet. But do we know if there's any elements of Shakespeare, maybe like his character development or the narrative structure, where it's clear that he's been influenced, but you perhaps wouldn't see in a really obvious way straight away?
Sure. You mean in terms of the characters that Shakespeare is creating?
Or like when Lewis is writing his fiction, is he influenced by the wider spectrum of some of Shakespeare, the way Shakespeare approaches his plays?
Yeah, that's a good question, I think. I mean, one of the interesting things that Lewis talks about when it comes to how Shakespeare creates his characters is the way that with Shakespeare, we talk about his characters as poets as well as Shakespeare as poets, right? And they get this kind of agency beyond, or seemingly almost beyond their author, right? And I think in terms of the sheer emphasis on dialogue and so on that we get in some of Lewis's writings, they're not plays, but he's very interested in those interactions with characters, which whether that's indebted to Shakespeare, I mean, it would be harder to tell, harder to make the case, but certainly that interest in how we see characters develop through their relationship with others and that sort of development. That's not unusual, but I think we can see that sort of emphasis on the characters as we almost think about Lucy as independent of Lewis, right? Not quite, but almost. And maybe there's a degree of that.
That's really helpful. Sarah, both Lewis and Shakespeare embed really complex theological and philosophical themes within their works. How do they incorporate some of these ideas? And how might the way they've done this inform or challenge our contemporary interpretations of their work?
Sure. Yeah. I guess in the case of both, they're still writing for audiences. This is especially true of Shakespeare, but to some extent still Lewis as well. Audiences who are going to have some degree of familiarity with the basic tenets of the Christian faith in a way that when I take my students to see a production of Shakespeare today, I can't necessarily make that assumption. Yeah. That's particularly true when I was teaching at the University of Buckingham, where it was a secular school, and so that there certainly wouldn't be that guarantee at all. I think one of the interesting things that they both sort of raise is they think about Christian modes of behavior and Christian ideas and notions, but don't necessarily do that in a particularly explicit Christian context. So they take them into other worlds, for example, right? So Hamlet is set in Denmark. It's not set in a necessarily particularly Christian world, though there are certainly Christian ideas and philosophies being articulated there. And perhaps the most famous speech from Hamlet is Hamlet's To Be or Not to Be, right? Where he's contemplating what lies beyond this world. Is there anything after death, basically? Is there eternal damnation? Now, he's being visited by the ghost of his father, so he knows there's a kind of purgatorial space, right? But he doesn't really know, and he's contemplating and he's wondering about what happens if I do this? Where will I go? And he has that very, very famous scene where he's holding up the skull, right? And he's contemplating what happens. Are we just bones? Or are we something more than that? Now, at no point is Shakespeare necessarily saying, well, and Christians think this, or so-and-so thinks that. But he is making us think very deeply about these issues and about not just the scene in front of us, but what happens to those characters beyond. Now, obviously, they're fictional characters, but they're representing real issues and real concepts. And Lewis does something similar, I think, when he's moving us into a kind of fantastical world, whichever world is that it's that we want to contemplate. He does this more explicitly in something like The Great Divorce, I guess. But if we take Out of the Silent Planet, for instance, we're thinking about death and life beyond as well. When the Hrasa is killed, that's deeply moving, even though we didn't really know that character. Mm. Not that well, right? But we are deeply moved by that display of grief. And that is significant and is something that I think Lewis is interested in making us think about, whether or not we then come to a kind of considered theological conclusion. He does talk about how he wanted to redeem the genre of science fiction. So he is also thinking about that.
I guess one of the things that is kind of linked to those big themes is the way they explore moral and ethical questions through their characters and narratives. Do you see any direct parallels between the two of them in how they handle these big questions?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think to some extent, yes. So to give an example of where Lewis uses Shakespeare in a less expected position, perhaps, than we might. There's a very, very famous scene that anyone who has read The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe or seen The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe will know. And I'm going to spoil it for those of you that haven't, but I'm sorry. when the White Witch is yelling at Aslan just before she kills him, when she's doing that, she says, and in that knowledge, she's just talked about how, you know, Edmund is not going to be saved. She's going to go and kill him anyway, even if Aslan's, you know, sacrificing himself. That's irrelevant. And she says, and in that knowledge, despair and die. She kills him, right? Now, despair and die is repeated multiple times just before Richard III wakes up and fights the Battle of Bosworth, where, of course, he also dies in Shakespeare's play. All of these ghosts who he's killed, all of these people, they keep coming up and haunting him and saying, despair and die, right? Now, Lewis may or may not have known, I mean, he knew that, whether or not he was deliberately thinking, oh, I remember that line from Richard III, I think is less clear. But that's a very clear example of thinking about evil and its consequences and what it does to the people who are the evil perpetrators. Because, of course, the White Witch is not just haunted. Aslan comes back, right? And Richard III, of course, and both of them die in those narratives as well. So that's a sort of less explicit, interesting link.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable.
We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there at premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.